Welcome to Africa in Transition, a CFR podcast discussing political and security developments across sub-Saharan Africa. My name is John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. I am joined today by Vincent McCourie, the host of the Voice of America's Africa 54, a daily African news roundup. Welcome, Vincent.
Thank you very much, Ambassador.
Today, we will discuss Kenyan politics on the heels of a tumultuous election cycle. To briefly summarize how we got to now, Uhuru Kenyatta won the presidential election that took place on August 8, 2017. Raila Odinga, the runner-up, challenged the results, and the Kenyan Supreme Court annulled the results, citing procedural irregularities. Another election was held on October 26, 2017. This time, Odinga and his supporters boycotted, arguing that the necessary changes had not been made to ensure a free and fair election, and Kenyatta won 98% of the vote. The results were upheld by the Supreme Court. Odinga, refusing to accept the legitimacy of Uhuru Kenyatta's second term, had himself sworn in as Kenya's People's President, and later set up a national resistance movement. On the morning of former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's visit to Kenya in March, Kenyatta and Odinga seemingly reconciled and pledged to begin a process of national reconciliation. Vincent, could we start with who are Kenyatta and Odinga?
Kenyatta and Odinga go back many years because the two of them are the sons of very, very key players in the independence of Kenya. Uhuru Kenyatta is the son of Kenya's first president, Jomo Kenyatta. Raila Odinga is the son of Kenya's first vice president, who later became like the doyen of the opposition, Jaramogi Oginga Odinga. So they are sons of the two men who literally were the first leaders of independent Kenya.
But they were also rivals.
They became rivals very quickly after a few years of working together. Oginga Odinga broke off from the government and became an oppositionist, and the rivalry continued for many years to the extent that at some point Jomo Kenyatta, in fact, put Mr. Odinga in detention for many, many years. House arrest, actually.
Now, in a country which is known for its ethnic divisions, are the two of different ethnicities?
Yes. There are members of two major ethnic communities in Kenya. Uhuru Kenyatta is a member of the Kikuyu, which is the largest ethnic community in Kenya. Raila Odinga is a member of the Luo community, the other really big ethnic group that is like second largest group in Kenya. And the two have had, of course, a certain level of rivalry because of those two men. The relationship between Raila Odinga's father, Oginga Odinga, and Jomo Kenyatta has actually shaped the relationship between the communities themselves.
Actually, that's an extremely interesting point. So the rivalry between the two ethnic groups, the current rivalry, owes much to the personal rivalry between the two political leaders.
Exactly. The first president, Jomo Kenyatta, because of his personal relationship with Raila Odinga's father, created certain images of what the Luo people are and managed actually to kind of get into the minds, especially of his community, as to who the Luos are, such that they developed a fear for them, a fear of the Luo people, and never wanted them to come to power because they believed certain stereotypes about the Luo people. And that has continued to haunt the relationship between those two communities.
So there is nothing deeply rooted in Kenya's history about this seeming ethnic rivalry.
No, this, it was political and it was personal. In fact, whenever it was convenient, the two communities have worked together very comfortably. You can go back to 2002, where Raila Odinga endorsed the Kikuyu presidential candidate, Mwai Kibaki, and in fact campaigned for him. And the Luo people voted almost to a man for Mr. Mwai Kibaki, who is a Kikuyu. At that time, they worked together politically, and there was no problem for the Luo people to vote for the Kikuyu candidate. Neither was there a problem with the Kikuyu people accepting the votes of the Luo people that made a Kikuyu become president. So whenever it had been convenient, they've worked together. So it's a very artificial enmity. If you look at it closely, it is always based on personal relationship between the Oginga family and the Kenyatta family.
I think this is an enormously important point because we Americans very often see ethnic rivalries as something immutable, as something that dates from the colonial or pre-colonial period. And what you are showing is that in this particular case, the personal rivalry came first and was then translated into a kind of ethnic rivalry.
Exactly. Over the years, if you observe very closely, you'll notice that different ethnic groups have actually politically worked together. There have been alliances across different ethnic groups. Whenever it served a political purpose, It was okay. These marriages survived for a time. So you could say the ethnic rivalry has been driven by the political rivalry.
And not the other way around.
Not the other way around. That is why Kenyans of different ethnic groups coexist very comfortably. They do things together. In fact, they intermarry. They play soccer together. Their kids grow up together. Sometimes they don't even know whether there's a difference between them until they're reminded by political players that, you know, we belong to this group and therefore those ones are our enemies.
And an election setting would be particularly vulnerable to that
very
sort of thing.
Very much so. And in fact, those rivalries have always magnified themselves during the election period. And only when the two particular ethnic groups are on the opposite side. And it's not all the time that they exist in the opposite side. There are times when they come together. And then suddenly they're hand and glove until the next election, and then they break apart.
Both Kenyatta and Raila Odinga are said to be very rich. How did they become rich?
Well, their fathers, of course, having taken the reins of power at the beginning of independence of our country, they had access to all the opportunities that existed at that time, because those were the first Africans to really get access to acquisition of wealth after the British left. Raila Odinga's father, Oginga Odinga, started businesses way back then, small business, invested in one of the major business that enriched that family was making gas cylinders. They own one of the biggest companies that produces gas cylinders. And after years of being very successful in this business, they, of course, expanded to other businesses. So there was legitimate business there. Kenyatta family, equally having had the opportunities at that time, invested in real estate, invested in hotel industry. They own vast land. Many people have questioned, really, how the land was acquired, especially by the Kenyatta family, because it's thousands and thousands of acres of land.
Oh, so really big holdings.
Big holdings. Yeah. And most of this land was that was actually vacated by the British colonial settlers. The land was supposed to have been returned to indigenous Kenyans, many of who fought for this land. So many people wonder, why would the Kenyatta family keep all this land when it should have been given to the people? So most of their wealth actually came from land holding and, of course, diversifying into banking, hotel industry, agriculture, horticulture, and so on.
So, in fact, in some respects, the two are rather similar. They are both highly successful business people.
They're capitalists.
Yes.
Very, very similar in many ways.
How exactly does politics work in Kenya? The Kenyan constitution, the new constitution, widely celebrated outside of Kenya, not least because of its provisions for decentralizing what had been a highly centralized system and its protection of human rights. And yet, we keep seeing what appear to be assaults by the government on the human rights of its opponents.
Kenyans for many years clamored for a strong constitution because under the regime of Daniel Arap Moi, Kenyans suffered a lot because it was a one-man show. It was a repressive, really ruthless constitution that had been left by the colonialists, or at least which was pegged to the colonial system of total subjugation. The first president and second president did not do anything to open up the space for political participation. So when the opportunity came, Mwai Kibaki, Raila Odinga, and other men who were at that time in the opposition, they worked to get Kenya a new constitution through a referendum, because that was what had been a big problem. When Moi left, the opposition actually had been using the constitution as a platform to get into a position of power. And most Kenyans embraced that because they wanted a real strong constitution that would protect them. They worked on this constitution. It was a result of a very rigorous exercise, which was a referendum throughout the country.
Yes.
And eventually the constitution was promulgated, and it was a beautiful constitution. If you look at it,
it's
a beautiful constitution. Here's the challenge. When it came to implementation, the same men who actually were behind the production of this, or the writing and promulgation of this constitution, found some part of it a little uncomfortable for them, because then they, in a way, started realizing they cannot enjoy certain privileges that come with absolute power, that their authority was weakened. So an example is the current president, Uhuru Kenyatta, finds himself in a position where he cannot do whatever he wants to do because you have a very strong judicial system. And that has made them very unhappy. For reasons that we don't understand, the same men that really wanted this kind of a constitution that gives powers to the different organs of government, they want to undo that. And last year, Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta, after having to go back to the polls when the Supreme Court nullified that election result, threatened to fix the Supreme Court. In fact, the judiciary. And why? Because it didn't like their ruling. What we are seeing progressively since then is an attempt to undermine the authority and credibility of the judicial system. So the government has continued to defy any court orders until today as we speak, where the courts, for example, ruled that Mr. Miguna Miguna, an opposition politician who had been early deported to Canada, should be allowed back into the country. The government didn't care, ignored that order, and defied the court. Another order was given by the court for the gentleman to be produced in court and for senior government officials to appear in court. They defied that order, and now they've been found in contempt of that court. And this is the High Court.
Miguna Miguna also has Canadian nationality, does he not?
He has Canadian nationality, and Kenya's constitution allows for dual citizenship. And therefore, that's why he went to court to fight against being deported as a Canadian, because he's also a Kenyan and has actually a Kenyan passport, Kenyan national ID, even has a Kenyan tax PIN. If you have that PIN as a Kenyan, it means you're a legitimate Kenyan citizen, PIN number.
Well, where is that going to end? If you have an assault on the judiciary, that ends up being an assault on the rule of law. An assault on the rule of law means the Constitution is either questioned or even set aside.
There were members of Parliament of the ruling Jubilee Coalition who actually last year said that as soon as Parliament opens, they are going to start a process of having the Chief Justice and the Justices of the Supreme Court fired. And yet, of course, under the current Constitution, they have security of tenure, but they want to remove that. So what we are seeing is that the only hope that Kenyans had, which is the Constitution and a strong judiciary, independent judiciary, is right now being threatened. And the reason why that is the major target is because if you take away the judiciary, if you take away the Constitution, that's it. You go back to authoritarianism, because then the president is answerable to nobody. And that is appearing to be the tendency we're seeing from the government is that there is almost a desire to undo that part, to literally undo with a strong judiciary. But to do with a strong judiciary is literally undoing the Constitution, because you take away all the safeguards. The hope was that a strong judiciary will help to interpret the law and therefore ensure that Kenyans are guaranteed their freedoms. The government seems to be determined to completely undermine the authority of the judiciary, which happens to be actually an equal arm.
Yes, as it is in the United States.
Exactly. Kenyans are concerned. They're worried because this was the only hope. In fact, right now as we speak, the Kenyan media has come under so much attack. And whenever I spoke to the journalists, they said, well, at least our hope is in the courts, because we can go to the courts.
Yes.
And the courts will rule in our favor.
Yes.
Because the Constitution is on our side. But we have seen the government actually defy even orders relating to freedom of press. Journalists, as we speak, yesterday were assaulted at the airport as they tried to cover Mr. Miguna Miguna, who has been staying at the airport because he couldn't be allowed into the country. Journalists were beaten. Some had to be taken to hospital. And the government has no apology, which shows that now journalists cannot have protection of their rights through the courts, because the courts are being defied at every level. So one journalist told me, we don't know where to turn to, because that was our hope. Yes, so Kenyans are concerned.
And with the reconciliation between Kenyatta and Odinga, essentially the opposition, the parliamentary opposition, is acquiescent or silent?
That is what a few members of the coalition that made the opposition NASA questioned that, said, okay, now, if you say we are making peace with the government before certain issues are resolved, then what happened to holding the government accountable? Who is going to hold the government accountable? Are we joining the government and therefore becoming part of the ruling party? And so at the moment it's confusing, because Mr. Raila Odinga's so-called handshake right now has not come with any details. So people don't understand, what is he up to? And members of the opposition have not bought into this. They have not all been sold into the idea, because first they don't understand what it all means. And of course, there are those who are eager to get in, for some people. Because again, unfortunately, some quarters of the political class is driven by personal interest. And some of them don't mind becoming part of the ruling government, ruling party, becoming beneficiaries of this government in some respect. But there are those who are legitimately questioning what would be the fate of the opposition's role of holding the government accountable if we were to literally join this government, and in which fashion, in which way. There are no details at the moment.
Finally, there's Cambridge Analytica, an organization about which we now know a great deal more than we used to. We know about its involvement in the Brexit vote in the UK, its apparent involvement in the American presidential elections, and I understand it also tried to play a role in Kenya.
Sure. When it came to light, in fact, it validated the concerns that were there among some people, especially in the opposition, that there was some kind of manipulation of things, whether it's information. That validated that accusation. In the beginning, nobody really knew what the opposition was talking about when they were talking about manipulation.
That's right.
But now this report about Cambridge Analytica has come to prove that claim, that there was some kind of mining into people's information and trying to use that to kind of manipulate people's way of thinking without anybody's knowledge.
Yes.
You know, people found themselves being driven into certain thoughts and perhaps, of course, use that to awaken their ethnic differences and try to read into how people can be influenced to behave in a certain way around the time of electioneering. And so it is of great concern, the interference in Kenya's political system. But it was not easy for anybody to know, because there was so much noise around the election, and nobody was acknowledging that there could be any form of manipulation or interference, except the fact that the opposition kept insisting, but nobody could tell exactly what was happening. But it was known that something was happening in the dark somewhere.
Well, insofar as it was involved in trying to sharpen ethnic differences, in a country with Kenya's history, that was extraordinarily irresponsible.
Totally so, because we've seen people die because of that. We saw in the year 2007 over 1,500 people die because of ethnic differences and clashes.
Stirred up by politicians.
Exactly. These are people who have lived together for years. But you can see what happens when things like this are manipulated by politicians or anybody. And it's a very dangerous thing for anybody to do. And I think it's callous for anybody to do something like this.
So a conclusion would be that Kenya has a leadership problem.
Kenya has a leadership problem, and this is why the problem will stay for a long time. We are yet to see a crop of Kenyan leaders who have real serious interest of the people at heart. We are seeing people are very individualistic, driven by personal ambition to be president, that's all. And once people are up there, the leadership position, the system is so weak that it's all about access to things. They surround themselves with people who want to benefit themselves from being in the positions of power. They stay in elected positions for as long as it can take for personal benefit. We're yet to see a leadership that is focused on really moving the country forward. And then, of course, the leadership keeps playing with the ethnicity to their advantage. And that's why you're going to see even now a lot of realignment when different leaders see that their ethnic groups can come together and serve their personal interest, they will unite. But after some time, if for some reason they don't think it's working, it disintegrates, and then other new alliances are formed around ethnic groups.
It's very fluid.
Very fluid.
Fixed principles.
We don't have a political party with a philosophy. We've never had one political party that has endured because it stood for something. If you look at the political landscape in Kenya and someone asks you, tell me about the political parties in Kenya, the ones that we knew 5 years ago don't exist because they switched positions, people changed the names of their political outfits, joined others, they morphed into something. So we used to have NPA, we had DP, we had ODM and all that, Orange Democrat. They all come together, they form something new. And if you look at the motivation, is the ethnic arithmetic. You just look at, if you take the people of your ethnic group, I take mine, we have a formidable force here, then I'll run for president, you be my running mate, the next time around, I'll support you. When somewhere along the way they realize that perhaps not one of them is not keeping up to the deal, they break away, form an alliance with another group. And all this is not because there's an interest in how our ethnic groups will benefit, but it's so much about, if I can use the numbers I have, could you help me to get into power? For me. Mostly it's for me, that's it.
So it's all about power.
It's all about power. And it's very sad.
For we Americans, Kenya is an extraordinarily attractive country in many, many ways, so many ways. And all we can do is hope that the democratic trajectory can be restored.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.